Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you're listening to episode 60 of the Matinee Cast. It's the Movie Loving podcast of my Movie Loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. After last week's episode with Joanna, where we talked about blogs and podcasts we dig, I realized a coincidental bit of happenstance was on tap. See, for the next four consecutive episodes, the people we mentioned on that show are going to be on this show.
Wow.
Totally unintentional. It fell that way because nice. Two of them weren't even blogs or podcasts that I chose. So that was kind of cool.
That's good.
I know. Yeah. My guest for episode 60 surprised me, though, is somewhat in his enthusiasm. You see, he listened to episode 50 and was tremendously effusive about how much he took from the Steven Spielberg discussion. And also, then and there, called dibs on the Prometheus episode. Which, if you want to get on my good side, call dibs on a Matinee Cast.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing gets me in a better mood. As I say, the enthusiasm surprised me not only from the standpoint of, you know, you were listening to my show. You've heard the show.
I listened to your show.
You get the live version.
That's true.
But also, since for me, impressing today's guest with content is kind of like making Johnny Carson laugh. Ask your parents, kids. He is one half of Memo, a show you can find at memo.ca and hosted through row3.com. Please welcome live in Casa del McNeil, Matthew Brown. How are you, sir?
I'm well. And not just impressing me with content about Spielberg, which, not to toot either of our horns, significantly harder. Like, you and Jake killed it in that episode.
Well, it was just one of those things, like, we all, you, myself, and basically everybody we know creates content.
Sure.
So it's kind of a little bit harder to get somebody to actually check out the content. We're all supportive of each other, of course.
Of course, but there's also a lot of it.
Yeah, so it was one of those moments where I was like, hey, he likes me. Just a reminder, in talking about the podcast on Twitter, I do so with a Twitter series I call Mike and the Mechanics. You'll find those if you follow my Twitter feed today being Monday, June 11th, or by searching #MATM60. Episode 60 might sound like we've hit shuffle, but we're going to try a few new things. We're going to discuss Prometheus, find out people's thoughts on prequels, and turn the record over and play the other side. Before that, we need to learn even more about Matthew Brown. This is Know Your Enemy. Matthew Brown is my first three-time guest not named Lindsay Rigoni. So he has already answered two rounds of Know Your Enemy questions and forced me to write a whole new series.
Yeah.
But to recap, his first film that he ever saw was A New Hope. The last film that he'd seen...
Please don't call it A New Hope.
The first film that he'd ever saw was Star Wars Episode 4.
Let's just go with Star Wars.
All right. The last film he'd seen at the time was Machete Maidens Unleashed.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how long ago that one was.
That's pretty good.
The worst film he'd ever seen was Pearl Harbor. The unseen classic or essential was Conan the Barbarian. Did you ever catch up with that?
I still haven't, but it's playing at the Lightbox this summer.
There we go. I expect you to cover it.
I am absolutely going to.
The film he wished he had a hand in making was the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Round two, the film that only he likes that nobody else seems to is Star Wars The Phantom Menace. The film that everybody else digs that he does not is The Princess Bride.
Yep.
Did you get hate mail?
No, but I mean, people know that of me, and nobody, like, it's like it's so unfathomable a concept that people just won't address it.
You know why else? Nobody listens to the show.
Oh, I see.
The last film to make him cry at the time was Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. I did not get the answer for In the Movie of Your Life, Who Plays You?
I said Benedict Cumberbatch.
You did. That is right. Okay. So, now we have a whole new series of questions, and you are the first one to break these in. So, first of all, what was the film that caused your love for movies to turn a corner, and you can take that question in whichever way you will?
The answer, and I really do not mean to drive people any crazier with this, is Pirates of the Caribbean 3 at World's End.
Why?
It's a long explanation.
We should back up by saying that you're possibly the only person I've ever met who actually really does care for that movie.
The first
time you told me you liked that movie, I swore you were kidding.
Yep, everyone.
Because you have a very dry humor anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, but
in a way, I am. Like, I mean, I've never said that I think Pirates 3 is a great film. It means a lot to me. It appeals particularly to my sense of whimsy. But the reason it's so significant is that it was that movie. I kind of feel like if you're a film fan, there's three levels of it.
Okay.
There's the beginning, where you're getting into movies and you haven't seen anything, so you're just gathering up content. You're seeing all the stuff that everyone tells you you're supposed to see. So you're gathering information, and what you're doing is you're building a framework for how movies work for you. Level two is where you're applying that framework to everything.
Okay.
Right? And that's where most people are. That's where a lot of bloggers are, and God knows I've been guilty of this for most of my life, right? You've got your set of rules for what makes a good movie, and you're just going to assess everything based on those rules.
Okay.
If you're lucky, and I consider myself extremely lucky, at some point you might get to the next level, which is when you realize those rules are just meaningless.
Okay.
Like, that it's the subjective experience at the end of the day of everything you see and do that matters the most. That you can have all of these, like, little substrates of, like, criteria for what makes movies good or bad.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, it's your gut feeling watching a thing that makes all the difference. And that happened to me watching Pirates 3.
I can't argue with that, and I think you may have just changed my whole outlook on life. What was your first date movie?
The only movie I can remember far enough back as being a movie I went on a date to was the Sandra Bullock movie where Bill Pullman jumps in front of a train or falls in front of a train.
Oh, it's When You Were Sleeping.
That's it, When You're Sleeping. That can't actually be the first one because I went on a double date to that with my best friend, and we were probably like 17. Okay. Like, I was definitely dating my second girlfriend, so I think it's impossible that I didn't take my first girlfriend to a movie as well. Like, that doesn't make any sense. But if I did, I cannot remember.
Okay, so we'll go with that.
So I think that's the first one I can remember.
And it was a double date.
Yeah, double date. It has one of the great moments of slapstick in the history of cinema, which is that in this otherwise incredibly, you know, boring romantic comedy, there's just, for no reason, there's a shot of the newspaper boy riding up the street, and he throws a paper off his bike and flips his bike completely over by accident, which is so out of character for that movie. It has nothing to do with the comedy style of that movie. And I just remember, like, I laughed for probably 5 minutes in an empty theater with my best friend and our two girlfriends.
Right.
Just for that.
Do you remember how the date went?
It went good.
Because that's one of the things. Like, I was talking with somebody the other day, and he was talking about going on a date, and the person who he asked to go with, he suggested that they go see Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. Okay. Now, of course, like, we're talking a 30-something-year-old person versus a 17-year-old, you know. But it's that kind of thing of when you choose the date movie. Sometimes it's kind of silly. It often is kind of silly. I've heard the first date movie a lot.
Sure.
And it's usually a real, like, it's never a good answer in terms of a film.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I'm trying to get out of this with whoever else.
No, it's never good. Like, if it was up to me, my first date movie would have been Jurassic Park. Like, I desperately, there was a girl I had a crush on that summer. I desperately wanted to take her to that movie. It just didn't work out.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
What's your sick day movie?
I like to watch extremely bad movies when I'm sick. Like, so the last time I was sick, I watched Mission Impossible 2 for the first time.
Oh, goody.
Like,
a lot of dubs, eh?
Yeah.
So something crappy.
Something crappy. Like, the next time I watch the Green Lantern movie, it'll be because I'm incredibly sick.
Did you buy that?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'll just, like...
You'll stream it or...
I'll stream it or I'll rent it or,
Netflix,
you know,
or something.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
Okay. Something really crap. That's okay. Now, but why?
I think just... I mean, it's the same reason I occasionally watch Batman Forever, which we were talking about a little bit earlier.
Yeah, but, okay, but follow me on this. Like, when I'm sick, I'm thinking about it, when I'm sick, I tend to eat, like, starch. I eat starch anyway, but, like, I need something of substance.
No, comfort food,
That strikes me as I'm sick, and yet I'm eating cotton candy.
Yeah.
And that's your deal.
It's like, if I'm feeling really bad, I almost want to feel worse. Like, it's like when you've got a fever and you put yourself in a hot bath to really bring the fever out. You know,
I guess it works. Okay.
It works. I think it's great.
What was the last film to leave you speechless?
Probably Lake of Fire. That was 2005.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
I didn't see it, but I remember, like, hearing everybody talk about it. Tell people about that, because I don't think a lot of people have seen that one.
Yeah, that's a documentary that Tony Kaye did about abortion. He did basically just sort of covered the abortion debate in the United States for, like, 20 years. Like, he was shooting footage from, like, 85 till it was done in 2005. It's all black and white. It is entirely nonpartisan. Like, it's not about whether abortion is right or wrong. It's really just about how kind of America... confronted this issue over the course of 20 years, and it's incredibly insightful, very depressing, obviously, and one of those movies that, like, when it was over, I just had to put my head between my knees and not talk for, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah. Well, okay. Knowing that one, like, that's one of the ones where you just tell me the title, and I'm like, I don't need to ask why.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, so that was the thing, just filling people in on on why.
Absolutely.
And last, and possibly the hardest question of the bunch, choose a film quote to be your epitaph.
Don't everybody thank me at once.
Congratulations. You are the nerdiest person ever on this show.
Well, it's good, right? Because
and I'm second most nerdy for knowing what you're talking about.
My thing was always, if I had a kid and I wanted to name him after a Star Wars character, I wouldn't call him Luke. I'd call him Ben. Because you'd never make the immediate connection between Ben Kenobi and Star Wars. It's too obvious and normal a name, right? Same thing with Don't Everybody Thank Me at Once. It is a line from Star Wars, which is a very important movie, but no one's going to get that.
Like, except it's just nice and subtle.
Except for you. Amazing. I'm glad you got it, because if I had to explain it here on your podcast, I would have been very upset.
Well, there we go. That is a lot more about Matt, and the next time he talks his way onto my show, screw it. You're writing your own questions.
I will. You know, I'll bring questions for you.
Oh, okay. Before we go on to feedback, I need to take a quick pause here and talk about the LAM, the Large Association of Movie Blogs. Every year, they have a little powwow and handout awards called the Lammies, and the nominations came down last week, I think. And I got a bunch of nominations. I've been nominated for Most Prolific, Best Award or Festival Coverage, Best Blog Design, the Brainiac Award, the Best Reviewer, the Best Podcast, and the Best Blog. I'm kind of speechless because, as I say, I write this crap and I talk this crap, but I'm constantly under the impression that nobody's reading or listening. So the fact, again, that other people who do this crap look at what I do and care for it means a lot to me. I don't really give a crap about winning, because judging me against other sites and other podcasts is damn near impossible, because I listen to what they do and I look at what they do and I rip it off of myself.
We all do.
So to say that I'm doing it better than they are, screw that shit. But to anybody who put my name down, or even if you didn't, if you put, there's a lot of other great people who got nominated as well. I thank you very, very much. And all I can say is go to the LAM, check out these sites that have been nominated, and surf around, because they are badass. So thanks for that.
Awesome.
Thank you again. And it's time to get some listener feedback. This is your chance to come talk to me. Episode 59, I posed the question about prequels, what people's thoughts are. We're going to talk about Prometheus, which we'll get to it, but I find it amusing now, having watched it, that the original sales line was, oh, this is not a prequel. This only takes place in the same universe. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there was a drastic rewrite. Maybe you can enlighten me on that later.
We can talk about
okay,
that.
Okay, but yeah, for anybody to ever claim this is not a prequel... Mm-hmm. I call shenanigans. I asked people what are their thoughts on prequels, and this one didn't quite get as much feedback as in the past, but thank you. Nick Hatt from Being Norma Jean said, I have nothing for or against prequels. Haven't seen any bad ones, really. She is not trying hard enough. I'm avoiding the Star Wars ones because I saw the original trilogy this year and liked them a lot, but didn't love them. And it seems if I do watch them, I'll hate the whole series.
It's certainly a possibility based on others.
Yeah, I was going to say. Sean Kelly from SK On Movies said, prequels may be interesting to watch, but at the end of the day, they don't matter since you already know where they're going. In fact, I'm getting sick of all the three types of quells: sequels, prequels, and requels. A sequel or prequel that is part remake, like The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to come up more, but to paraphrase your project, does anybody remember how it ends? If you do... You know what's coming. And I think that's a few more people are going to mention this, but I think that is
the ultimate
test for anything, because you know where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. So you're taking most of the rules of telling a good story and just, you know, taking out probably the best piece of ammunition. Alex the Film Forager from Boston. I think the idea is often better than the execution. There are a lot of background stories I would love to see, but if actually made, it usually doesn't turn out well. I am anxiously awaiting a Black Widow Hawkeye prequel.
I'd watch that.
I would definitely watch that.
Yeah.
Let's make this happen. They've got the best butts of anyone in the movie.
They really do.
I don't know.
There's that one shot.
Hulk has a great ass.
He does, but there is that one shot where she walks into Loki's cell where you're just like, oh my God.
Note to self, rent.
And I'm not an SJO guy. Like, not really, but yeah. Oh my God.
That's. You know what? I actually didn't read that before I could drop that in, so that's a pretty good one.
Yep.
Stevie Taylor from New Zealand, writer of The Cinematic Paradox, said, I'm neither here nor there on prequels. They must be so meh to me, because the only prequel that comes to mind is Puss in Boots. I totally forgot about that shit. That's only a year old.
Of course,
that
is a prequel, yeah.
And that movie wasn't very good. We're getting animated prequels now. That's how far down the road we've got. Like, what is it, next year we're going to get Monsters University?
Yes, we are. Yeah. Again, you know what was funny? There was an article on InMovies.ca this week about prequels because of this, and they actually named the one that I never think of as a prequel, and yet is probably the best prequel ever made, which
Temple
is
of Doom?
Temple of Doom. Yeah,
because it came. Nobody looks at the date. No,
you know,
ever. But
it does actually nicely explain some elements of Indy's character in Raiders.
You know, we'll get to this, but one set of prequels I would love to see. I want the Indiana Jones trilogy where they tell me the adventure he's having before the movies.
Sure.
You know, because every story begins with the end of the last
adventure.
Yeah, I want those.
I would love to know. I mean, particularly with Temple of Doom, I would love to know what the deal was with Lao She.
With Lao She?
Yeah.
And plus, you get a whole movie without Kate Capshaw.
I like Kate Capshaw.
No, you're one of those. Justin Mohareb, I pronounced it wrong last time, said, as for prequels, generally unnecessary. The Before Watchmen minis for a graphic novel, for example, seem to be just putting up things we'd already read. Did you see those?
I have not. The first one, I think, came out this week. I've downloaded it. I have not yet read it. I am highly suspect of the entire enterprise.
Star Wars prequels are the top example of giving us the part of the story we didn't want. I also haven't seen The Godfather 2. Well, Justin, get on that.
Yeah, seriously.
Book-wise, Lord of the Rings was a sequel to The Hobbit. Film-wise, The Hobbit is being released as a prequel to the Lord of the Rings films. And we talked about this earlier. That's going to be my biggest handcuff with The Hobbit, is I know where it's going.
Uh-huh.
You know, and don't get me wrong, I know there's some cool shit that happens in The Hobbit, but...
it's a problem.
It is.
Yeah.
And I think it has dulled my enthusiasm. Nick from Cinema Romantico said, I think it's a case-by-case basis. They can be great in cases like Godfather 2. See, there you go. Justin, go watch it. Where they deepen and add extra layers to the saga. But like much of the discussed Star Wars prequels, they take away a great deal of mystery and prevent the audience from filling in the blanks and imagining off-screen details in their own way. Now, this is going to take a second. Jake Cole, who was on the infamous Spielberg episode, said, the problem with prequels isn't so much that they tell stories for which you already know the ending, but that they remove anything the audience might intuit from a character. Isn't Darth Vader so much scarier when his downfall is left to the imagination rather than shown as a young adult's uncontrollable temper? I used to see Heinrich Himmler when I saw Vader. Himmier? Heinrich Himmier?
No, that's a Nazi.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, okay.
An actual Nazi.
Oh, I'll be okay. Now I see, I'm learning something every day.
Yeah.
Now I see a roid raging fraternity jock. The only prequel I can think of that really gets it is Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. It helps that the preface is a nonsensical show, but it may be the best thing Lynch has ever done, and certainly my favorite. It's darker than anything else he's made. Wow. But also more human and less glibly ironic. It also provides in a roundabout emotional closure for the show's cliffhanger ending. Finally, David Bishop said, I haven't seen it, but I hear The Godfather Part 2 is the one to get it right. Come on, people! I do think some stories warrant a prequel. I truly believe that Star Wars did. This is the one that's coming up quite often. But it was executed poorly. I think Anakin's downfall could have been something worth visiting. This is something we already said. But it felt like the transition from young adult angst to slaughtering younglings was too sudden and without full justification. Now,
he loved Natalie Portman.
If there's not enough
justification there.
He also hated sand. It was coarse and rough and got into everything.
It got into everything, yeah.
You know what the funny thing is? Up until probably this week, I would have been very much of this opinion. But I really think there is a way to tell these stories well. Like, you almost need to just basically take the universe and blow it the shit up.
Yeah.
And say, what else is out there?
You also, I mean, I just feel like you need to put a lot more imaginative investment into coming up with the story if you have to land on a certain point. Yeah. If you have to land there, there's got to be a way you can get there that's not the obvious way, that isn't just the A to B of sort of, yeah, we're going exactly where we expected. Like, just throw in something that totally... That's one of the things I like about Prometheus, where it's like, so throw in something that just radicalizes what you thought was going on.
It's kind of funny. The one prequel that I was thinking about all week that nobody mentioned that I think really gets it right, and they completely go to where you think they're gonna go, is Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, you know,
it kept it pretty simple. You knew it was gonna end with the monkeys taking over, and even still, like, they didn't completely take over. I don't know, like, that film seemed to have a lot of joy in coloring in some of the pages that some of the stuff we already knew.
Yep,
because you know it's coming off a series of like six previous films, that kind of thing.
Depending on how you define it, because it's also a reborquel Casino Royale. Like that.
Oh yeah, thank you. That is my other one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that one is pretty much strict character development.
Yep.
You know, with a little bit of action thrown in.
Yeah, and you know you're going to get to the end where he says, "I'm Bond, James Bond," but like how we get there is obviously enthralling, which who thought the 21st James Bond movie could be enthralling?
Could be one of the very best.
Yeah.
You know, without question. Like, you talk about the top James Bond movies. That one comes up.
Five.
There we go, folks. That's prequels. Next episode, which will come up in 2 weeks, we'll be talking about Brave. And I want to know about a very specific question. So I do apologize because I'm getting really nitpicky on this one, but bear with me. I want to know, what is people's least favorite Pixar film and why? And here's the caveat. I am throwing out the Cars films because everybody's going to choose them. So forget those films exist. And I actually like the first Cars movie too. Other than those films, what is your least favorite Pixar film and why? Let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, Facebook, all sorts of ways to reach me. Your least favorite Pixar film. We'll be right back after this with the new slang, Prometheus. I will beg people's indulgence because we have actually just come back from seeing Prometheus. And this is a rare instance where we are recording before I've even written about the movie. I have been able to hash out my feelings on it on the 20-minute subway ride here, but I'm kind of going to be reaching a little bit more than usual. But Prometheus is directed by Ridley Scott. It is written by Damon Lindelof and John Spates. Are they pronouncing his name?
Spates, yep.
Spates. Stars Noomi Rapace, Charlize Theron, Michael Fassbender, Idris Elba, and Guy Pearce. Prometheus is the prequel to Alien, Ridley Scott's classic 1978 sci-fi film. It takes us back to the planet which that film landed on in the beginning, where the warning beacon came from, in the search for the origins of human life, I guess we can say.
Mm-hmm.
I should also say, in case you've gotten this far, we need to spoil the holy shit out of this movie.
Okay, I was going to ask.
Yeah. Usually we try to keep things fairly clean. However, first of all, the fact that we know where this movie's going to go, and second of all, the fact that it's towards the end of this film where everybody seems to be losing their minds, we really need to break this one up. So if you haven't seen it and you want to go in with a clear mind, which I do suggest you do, skip ahead to the next section. But if not, we're going to go from here. Matthew Brown, what do you think of Prometheus?
I think that movie's terrific. Okay. I had obviously incredibly high expectations because I'm an enormous Alien fan, and not just of the first film, but the entire franchise.
All of them.
Yeah. I have obvious problems with 3 and 4.
Okay.
Because everybody does. But it's an incredibly strong body of work because I don't view it as a saga.
Okay.
Right? I don't think it's a four-part narrative. Each one is basically an anthology piece by a different visualist director who brings amazing things. Like, I find the franchise fascinating for that reason.
So coming back to it now, after basically 15 years away,
about that, yeah,
30-something years after it started, what do we think of this now this addition to the saga?
Well, my honest preference, if you'd asked me 3 years ago, would have been I would rather see another new director do Alien 5.
Okay.
Then Ridley Scott do this thing that he's been talking about for freaking ever.
Okay.
Which is the where do the space jockeys come from question.
Right.
Because I don't care about the space jockeys. I never did.
Okay.
I didn't find it that interesting. I think it's a great piece of the original film, but I also like films that have a little bit of mystery to them. I don't need that explanation.
No.
But that said, what he's done here, I think, is such a fascinating piece of science fiction and is so committed, so well done, and just has so much stuff in it to think about and to marvel over on every level, visual, storytelling, whatever else, that I'm like, yeah, Ridley Scott, brilliant. Like, yeah. good on you for actually pulling this off.
Right.
Like, one of the few prequels I can think of. And it certainly is a prequel.
Yeah.
But not as direct a prequel as you'd think. And I think that's part of the key.
Well, it's funny, because I actually disagree. I think that we were saying before that this was originally called a spiritual sequel that exists in the same universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there was a drastic script rewrite or not, but I don't know how in the world they ever thought that this was not a prequel, because everything that happens in this movie is very much tied to where we go, certainly with Alien.
It's not exactly the same thing. You're seeing some elements of a larger puzzle, but you're not seeing the whole puzzle, and I think that's what, you know, where the...
Even with that, though, I was kind of surprised at how much I really loved this movie.
Sure.
This might be the most epic looking and sounding and feeling film that I have seen in a long time. And I don't just say that because we went and saw it in IMAX and 3D and all that jazz. Even if I had just seen this on a regular 2D screening and just sat down close so that I could feel my vision, this movie is friggin' huge.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly the biggest thing that Scott's ever done.
I'd say you're probably right.
Yeah, everything. Like, every set, every shot makes you feel this big, and it's audio, so you can't see that my finger and my thumb are maybe a quarter of an inch apart. And it in a very, very organic way. Not everything really feels all that digital. It really looks as though he got the look of it right.
I cannot believe the special effects in this, because I know they're not on an alien planet. I know that, like, a ringed planetoid is not in the sky. I know those pyramids aren't there. They look absolutely photoreal.
This has been, not to digress too far, but this has actually been a very good summer for the gravity of special effects.
Absolutely.
Like we saw this in Avengers 2, where you saw pixels fighting pixels, as our friend Corey Pierce likes to say, but did so in a way that felt very genuine. It feels like we've come a very, very long way in a rather short amount of time.
Yes.
For that kind of thing. I'm kind of curious, because you said that after you saw this movie, you had to go home and think a lot.
Yeah.
To write. I know I will have to as well. Of course, I'm going to have the advantage of sussing it out with you here first.
Sure.
What did you really have to weigh on in this movie? There's a lot of themes, and we will talk about that, but what was really weighing you down in terms of coming up with your overall thesis on the film?
The hardest thing for me to suss out was the film's take on spirituality and religion and atheism, which is actually, I think, surprisingly complex.
Yeah.
I'm an atheist, so as soon as you show me a movie where there's a lead character who's a scientist and yet is also a believer in God, I'm having a problem, because I don't get that person. I don't understand where she's coming from. One of the reasons Prometheus is successful is I felt absolutely in love with Ellie by the end of that movie, because she goes through such a powerful process of her beliefs being challenged and then figuring out who she is and what that means, that by the end, by the final third, I'm absolutely with her. If she is my avatar, for lack of a better word, in this movie, can I get behind what she believes and what she's trying to do? And what it comes down to me, and hello again with the spoilers, at the end of that movie, when she decides that she wants to continue, that she wants to explore further into the universe, it's the first alien movie where the characters aren't heading back to Earth at the end.
Yeah.
So she wants to go out. When she makes that decision, I think that is a brilliant, beautiful moment, and a brilliant commentary on the human condition. People literalize things too much now, right? So you look at this movie where they say that the human race was seeded by these other creatures millions of years ago.
Yeah.
And they might say, well, I don't believe that, and I can't go along with it.
I was going to say, it's fiction.
Exactly. Emphasis on fiction.
If that's your problem, if you can't get behind that, because one of the things that actually really helped me in this film was the reaction that was coming down this week and how it was checkered.
Yeah,
shall we say?
Very.
And I was like, all right, what in the world is coming? I expected the last 15 minutes of this movie to be somewhere in between The Tree of Life and 2001, A Space Odyssey. And when it was this linear, I was like, what in the world are people hanging up on? And yeah, when I put together that it was our genesis as a race comes from some other alien race, and that idea is not 100% mapped.
Yeah.
Who the hell cares?
The science fiction trappings are important, and I think it's good science fiction, but at the end of the day, it's like, here's what's the story saying about the human condition? And what it's saying, it's taking a very specific myth, the Prometheus myth, it's saying our tendency to kind of go digging in for knowledge that we think we want can really bite us in the ass, right?
Yeah.
That's the upshot of that's the moral of that story.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, at the end, the human condition is, we're just going to do it anyway. We're going to keep... doesn't matter. You can bite us in the ass as hard as you want, God. We're going to keep asking.
Yeah.
Because that's who we are.
One of the standouts for me in this movie is Michael Fassbender.
Sure.
As David. He's the android.
Mm-hmm.
I think every Alien film, at least the first two, had an android in the crew.
Three doesn't have a new android. It has Bishop again. You know what's weird that got pointed out to me this week? First film, it's Ash. Second film and third film, it's Bishop. Fourth film, it's Call. And this film, it's David. So A, B, C, D.
Oh,
weird
wow.
Coincidence.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Holy. Fassbender, we both watched Alien this last week. He really gets the spirit of Ian Holm right in his delivery. There's a very fine line between stunted and cold. You know?
Yeah.
And I think if between this film and Shame, if you ever need a guy to play cold, Fassbender's your dude.
Sure.
He nailed this movie for me. in his every little way, in the way that he's kind of this little hodgepodge of a lot of the characters we've already met.
Mm-hmm.
He's part Ash, he's part Paul Reiser, and he brings it together into this guy whose motivations we have no idea basically where he's going other than to serve, you know, the greater mission.
Yeah.
He plays really well off of Charlize Theron. Even just the way he's introduced, mm-hmm. having his run of the ship, playing basketball, basically trying to be human,
yeah.
right? He's kind of, there's little bits of him, like you said, of David in AI.
Mm-hmm.
And watching Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
And mocking both in terms of tone and talk and even his friggin' hairstyle.
Yep.
Mocking Peter O'Toole.
Yeah.
And if you have the stones to have one of your characters watching one of the greatest films of all time within your film, that's ballsy, right?
Absolutely.
There.
It was a real, and it's right at the beginning of the film, it was a real level setter for me where I was like, oh, this is ambitious.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They're not pulling these punches.
Yeah. So, and of course, he has a great amount to do with where this story ultimately goes.
Yeah, because he's basically the Joker. Like, he's the thing that, every time the plot needs to get goosed, like, pushed forward, he does something to push it forward.
Yeah.
A lot of people do a lot of dumb things in this movie. Not him. He's always acting with this, like, you don't really know what it is, but this malign purpose to kind of move it forward.
I was a little disappointed with that in this, but, well, the first film, Alien's a bunch of wreckage.
Yeah.
Crew members. I don't expect them to be particularly bright.
Right.
These guys are supposed to be scientists.
For scientists, these
thought,
are so
yeah,
dumb
scientists.
Yeah, they make a lot of very obvious mistakes. Which, again, you know, one of those things that it initially was difficult for me to reconcile, because it's like, one of my biggest problems is, can I like characters that are dumb? And at the end of the day,
apparently, yes, you can.
All the dumb characters in this movie don't make it.
No.
And the character that figures out that she was being dumb is the heroine, and she survives.
Yeah. So we were having a question about prequels earlier on in the show.
Yeah.
I would put it out that this actually might be the prequel that eclipses its original story, because its original story, Alien, is 10 Little Indians. It's Jaws on a freighter.
Yeah.
Is what it is. This has more ambition, by far bigger scope.
Totally.
And says, quite literally, I've got a lot more story to tell. So is this perhaps a prequel that eclipses its original?
I think it'll be many years before we really know. Alien has an elegance and a simplicity to it that this film will never have, because it is doing something that is just more complex.
It's also got a grind.
Level.
And I think that's the difference, is that you could not get two films that look so polarly different than these two movies.
And yet, like, It fits. It has the same rhythm. It taps a lot of the same bases as it goes along, which I also really like, because it's not just a prequel. It sort of feels like an echo. Like they're just refracting what was there originally.
We usually end every review with the souvenir. The one thing, be it a shot, a scene, a line, don't everybody thank me at once, that you want to take away from the film if you could. So if you were to keep one thing from Prometheus, what would you want as your souvenir?
And for me, it is, like as I was saying, it is the shot of the engineer spacecraft taking off with Ellie and David's head aboard, and her saying, "And I'm still searching." Like that shot, as it kind of goes into hyperdrive,
and a very direct call to the first movie.
Absolutely, a total rewrite of the end lines of the first movie. But like, I watched this movie, and this may be naive or stupid of me, but I honestly watched this movie not thinking, everyone's pissed off this week because they think they're setting up a sequel. And yes, they're probably setting up a sequel. And I don't
think
care.
So.
Like, the movie is such a perfect self-contained
piece.
I
don't think they are.
Well, they may be or they may not. I wouldn't, you know, I'm not.
I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised, because they leave a few ambivalent questions, just as any story does.
Yeah.
But I don't really think that that's where they're going with this.
Well, it didn't occur to me until other people were pissed off about it.
But that final...
So that shot, and I don't care if we never find out what happened to it.
Yeah.
But like the mental adventures that I can have with Dr. Elizabeth Shaw will carry me off for many, many nights.
For me, it's something completely trivial, but something I loved and gave the film just that little human touch, that little bit of cheek. Idris Elba in his little squeeze box.
Sure.
Sitting there playing Love the One You're With. And, you know, the first time he's playing, and it's like something a monkey would have on a street corner.
Yep.
It's the silliest little detail.
Yeah.
I love that it's there. I love that he plays it. It's not just that it's hanging around. He actually plays it, and he even uses it to like a little jump scare. It's a great little touch.
Yeah. And there are so few little kind of the movie barely has time for it, like character moments like that. And I, that was that moment that I realized that I think Elba is there basically to stand in for the characters from the original film.
Who were he's Yavakoto.
Yeah. He's the blue collar guy.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about all this science shit. No. He just wants to go home.
That's right. He wants to get paid.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we give these films a score on a scale of 1 to 4. So, Matthew Brown, what do you give Ridley Scott's Prometheus?
I have been giving it the top marks all week in every other format, so why not 4 out of 4?
This is a 4 for me, too. This is my first 4 of 2012.
Wow.
Yeah, this is, at the moment, this is the best film I have seen all year. I did not expect to like this nearly as much as I did. Certainly not in the last week with everybody starting to raise a fracas. And if anything, that actually put me into the right headspace going in. So yeah, this film is a 4 out of 4 for me. I'm sure listeners are going to disagree with me like no tomorrow. Some of you might agree, I don't know. But let me know what you think. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, Facebook, I'd love to hear it. We usually do a top 5 at this time, or once in a while we've done Hot Topic. But we're not going to do that this time. We're going to try something totally and completely different. Come on back and I'll explain the other side. So we're going to try something a little bit different. I wanted to think about pairing the film that we're discussing with another film, almost like a double feature, a compliment film, and actually talk about that film to a further degree, almost like another review, but with greater context, because a lot of these films, it can be something that came out 20 years ago, 30 years ago, not quite a review, but digging a little deeper than the 5 minutes or so that I spent on them with Hot Topic. So I pose to you, if you can pair a film with Prometheus, what would you choose? And you chose Kingdom of Heaven.
I did.
Ridley Scott's film from 2005. And I want you to be honest right now with me and my 6 listeners. Did you only choose it because you'd already watched it by that point?
No, well, I mean, it was fresh on my mind, but I had actually, when you asked me, I'd already seen Prometheus. And I actually think there's a similar strategy in both films, because he's using a story that's set in another time and place, either the Middle Ages or 100 years in the future, to address actually very current concerns. In Kingdom of Heaven, it was strife in the Middle East, and in Prometheus, it's essentially creationism versus Darwinism.
Right. Well, I only ask because when, like, you suggested Kingdom of Heaven, I was like, oh, that's when you think Ridley Scott, that's not always the one people go to, although nope. Among our kind of circle, that's one of these, like, misunderstood classics. But the next day was when our post went up. By the way, if you're listening to this, go to row3.com, and there's a lot of content about Ridley Scott, and there's a long post where Mr. Brown writes about a few films. You wrote about Robin Hood.
I wrote about Robin Hood and Kingdom of Heaven.
Kingdom of Heaven.
Post.
I wrote about Thelma and Louise. Yeah, the next day
yeah.
it went up. I'm like, well, of course you chose Kingdom of Heaven.
No, it was nice timing.
So,
yeah.
Okay. So the why then is, so why do you think that marries up with Prometheus very well? You kind of already explained it.
Yeah, again, it's the strategic thing of like how he's, because I think, and it's not the main strength of either film, but I think it's really interesting that, you know, like for me, Kingdom of Heaven is absolutely a period film, and yet the dialogue is really 2005. Like, it is written in a very modern context because it's, you know, written about something that's happened. You couldn't make that movie about the Middle East now. Right, you couldn't make, Ridley Scott couldn't go make a 3-hour war movie in Baghdad now.
No,
like it's just
he tried,
and it's
like
just,
three years later, he's like, well, let's take those ideas and set him against the actual war on terror.
Yeah,
and guess what? It didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. So instead, he shunts it into arguably an even greater cataclysm in the history of human combat, which is the Crusades. Like, people don't understand how awful the Crusades actually were. We use the word crusade to mean, you know, righteous quest.
Yeah.
Crusade should mean jihad,
yes.
Right? It is religious war at the absolute highest level of slaughter.
Yes.
So for him to kind of take these concepts of, and he's got a character who I'd argue from the beginning of the film to the end goes from being a man of faith to being an atheist. He's got characters who are religious on both sides of, but one, some are on Islam, some are Christian, and strongly believe what they believe in and bring those into the moral quagmire as well. Everyone has a viewpoint in that movie, and they all make sense, and they're all just in conflict with each other because nobody's viewpoints marry one another well.
The thing that I took away from it the most, and the thing, like, you know, my own, not to get too far off on a tangent here because it is supposed to be a movie podcast, but my own ideas of faith have changed as I grow up, as I think everybody should.
Sure.
And whether you stay where you are or you just completely go to something different, you should kind of always be asking questions, is just my take on it. And the thing that I came up with that I kept it stuck in my craw as I rewatched this film. And by the way, thank you, because I hadn't seen this film in 7 years.
Yeah.
So I was essentially just watching it again for the very first time.
I saw it 2 years ago and I can
remember. I remembered very little bits, I'll get back to that. But the thing that stuck in my craw was the several times that the Christian Crusaders yell out and declare as if it's their the argument to end all arguments, God wills it.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
Of course.
If God will, God is pretty damn good at whatever he wants to will. He's come up with drought, he's come up with flood, famine. If he wants a whole bunch of Muslims gone, he will get rid of them.
Yeah.
But it's the old adage of if God's on our side, who do they have? Right. Well, it works both ways.
Absolutely.
And that was the thing. So yeah, it is, like you said, it grafts a very, very current concept and story and something that I think
concern, right?
And I think something that, let's be honest, 80% of the population has no idea even happened.
No.
You know, if you were to go out on the street right now and ask, hey, what do you think of the Crusades?
Even if people know about the Crusades, they sure as hell don't know that Christianity, the Christian forces, took Jerusalem and held it for 100 years at relatively peacefully.
Yeah.
Like, if you told people that Christianity was in charge of Jerusalem for a century, like, nobody would say that they knew that. That's a trivia question that'll stump the band.
Now, the other thing that's kind of cool about Kingdom of Heaven on a technical level is that it demonstrates how much Ridley Scott loves the director's cut how that really changes his film. We were talking on the way over here about Blade Runner, and that's probably the classic example because that thing went through several iterations until we arrive at what we've got now. The director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven, drastically different,
substantially
than what I saw in 2005. Much longer, much more characters moments. Still flawed.
Oh, totally.
That's the thing. Yeah. That's the funny thing. He got final cut on this DVD, and he still couldn't quite nail it.
Yeah.
But better than what we saw.
Yes.
And that's the thing. And he does this time and again. I have a hunch that when this thing hits Blu-ray next year or the year after, we'll see an even longer cut that goes even deeper into the space jockeys and what they were doing and everything.
He said that we won't, and I
really
I assume he's just
no
wrong.
Way. Yeah, I was gonna say there's
dude
no way.
Dude did a director's cut of Robin Hood. You know, like he'll do a director's cut of anything.
Yeah,
and even in Robin Hood, it improves the film. Like they're always, but I feel like Kingdom of Heaven, the long version, is still not long enough.
Really? You know,
like, it's, what, 3 hours and 15 minutes now?
Yeah.
It's like, that movie could be 5 hours long.
It's two DVDs. Thanks for that.
Yeah, no problem. It's a long movie, you know? But it's like, with it longer, you almost get the sense that all of the additional stuff he's putting in could even be explored further, you know?
Oh, yeah. Like, well, the funny thing is, I think he pays attention to the wrong parts, because most of... He gives us a lot of prologue, which I liked. I liked all that stuff when they come up on top, but when they come up to... Orlando Bloom's character's name is
Balian.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Balian. When they come up to Balian in the village, and he's the blacksmith, and they're basically trying to recruit him into the Crusades. I liked hashing that out longer. I liked getting to know him and his place in this village, and that sort of thing. Once he arrives in Jerusalem, I wanted to speed things along.
Mm.
I wanted to get more into the conflict within the Christians there. And certainly the battle with the Muslims later. And maybe a little bit more with the king.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, if you don't know who plays the king in Kingdom of Heaven...
It'll blow your mind.
Yes, it will. And just have good ears, because you will not see his face. The director's cut, I don't think it's necessarily a complete excuse. So, like, if a film doesn't quite nail it on theatrical release, I don't think it's permissible to say, well, just wait till the director's cut and that'll explain it all. But I think that he's using it in such a way... to tell his story, and he's done it with this, he's done it with Blade Runner, he's done it with, I think, damn near all of his movies. Like he said, he did it with Robin Hood?
He did.
What does he add into that?
Just more politicking and stuff like that. And there's this, I don't know if you remember, there were these children that lived in the forest.
That were completely unexplained.
Well, they're explained.
Oh, how about that?
No, I think Robin Hood is another very much underappreciated
I dug it.
Scott film. The director's cut is great.
Okay.
better lead character in Robin Hood, because the problem with Kingdom of Heaven at the end of the day is Orlando Bloom can't pull it off.
No, no. Now, the funny thing, Kingdom of Heaven, again, 7 years old now, I present to you that in the age of Game of Thrones,
yeah,
if you were to release this now, it would be at least a middling hit. This thing did nothing at the box office.
It was a terrible disaster.
Came and went and gone.
Yeah.
I think now it would land. I also think it came too late, because if you had dropped it more in the middle of the Lord of the Rings films,
sure,
when Bloom was really at his zenith, you might have been able to capitalize on that.
Yeah.
So I put to you that it just completely missed its mark.
It was one of those kind of deeper impact Armageddon situations too, because you'd also had Troy, I think, either earlier year or just the year before.
That's right, too.
And that's just too many of these kind of, like, let's take a completely improbable Hollywood pretty boy, in that case Brad Pitt, and put them in these ancient battles.
It was the ripple effect of Gladiator, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Lord of the Rings, of that sort of awareness that, holy shit, people will pay all this money to see gigantic battles in front of castle walls. Let's do as many of those as we can. And, you know, I can see why Ridley Scott would want to do it.
Yeah.
He's rarely made a film that looks better than Kingdom of Heaven. Like, it's an extraordinary looking film. But he cast the wrong main guy. So, like, I mean, I can't even believe Orlando Bloom as a blacksmith, let alone as the crusader that held Jerusalem against Saladin. Like, for God's sake, one of the greatest battle commanders in the history of the human race, but Orlando Bloom stopped him for 3 days. No.
No. Now, of course, we kind of touched on this already, so we won't drive it too far into the ground. I think the ultimate takeaway from both Kingdom of Heaven, and this is kind of how it ties into Prometheus, is the lengths people will go to for what they believe.
Sure.
You will lead people across the furthest distance of the galaxy to get an answer. You will slaughter thousands upon thousands of non-believers because you think you are right. And it's the kind of thing that keeps coming up in his movies, of conviction, whether it's a good idea or not.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things. What would be your final takeaway from Kingdom of Heaven? Like, if somebody was to watch this, if they'd never seen it, what would you say? Watch it, but watch it for this.
Well, I mean, what I should say is watch it, but watch it for the accurate portrayal of the carnage and slaughter of the Crusades. But what I always end up saying,
which does take up quite a bit of time.
Sure. But what I always end up saying is watch it for the moment where Liam Neeson said that he once fought for 2 days with an arrow through his testicle.
Did I miss that line? Is that actually in there?
It is. Yeah, they're talking about, like, pain and hardship. And
I do remember I fought for 2 days with an arrow. I think I must have just...
Yeah, no, he just says, I once fought for 2 days with an arrow through my testicle.
Wow.
And that's like, yeah, that was the moment. You know how Liam Neeson now is this ultimate badass?
Yeah.
That was the moment it started.
By the way, we didn't really mention this cast in this movie.
Incredible.
Holy hell. Besides Orlando Bloom and Liam Neeson, you've got Eva Green, like, was she always in this?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Wow. But the whole thing with her son is not in the theatrical cut, so she's in
no.
a lot
yeah,
less.
There's that.
Yeah.
Jamie Lannister from Game of Thrones is
in it for like 6 seconds.
Exactly.
Yep,
yeah. David Thewlis. Holy hell, David Thewlis.
Yeah.
He's in it. Brandon Gleeson and Jeremy Irons. Oh, this movie's awesome. And, like, for me, actually, the thing that I did remember, the line that I love, is when they're trying to find where they're going, well, go that way until the men speak Italian, then keep going until they speak something else. I love that line. That might be one of my favorite lines ever.
And it gives you a sense of what it must have been like to navigate across the continent then.
At
right?
that time,
like, you didn't
have
GPS.
No.
It's just like
that was the
kind
closest thing
feel
you
your way through it.
Yeah, what accent are they speaking? What language are they speaking?
Yeah.
You know,
how
something
far have
different.
I gone?
Yeah.
6 months? Okay.
Yeah. No, that would Kingdom of Heaven would make a great double feature. It would make a long double feature.
Oh, sure.
With Prometheus. Because Prometheus isn't exactly succinct either. It's two and a bit.
It's two and a bit, but I mean, one of the things I think about Prometheus that is amazing is it is just so sharply edited. Like, there's no fat on that.
No, I looked down at my watch at one point, and I'm like, holy crap, we're this far in?
Yeah.
Like, because I was like, I feel like this movie just started.
Yeah.
And that's the other reason why I think there's a longer cut coming.
No, you might be right.
Because they got
you
it in like
right.
2 hours and 5. I'm like, there's another 25 minutes sitting there somewhere. But no, those two movies would go really, really well together for reasons that we've stated, which will also come up in the next film we talk about, which we'll talk about right after this. I had the disadvantage to try and come up with my other side my flip side of the record that is Prometheus, because I had not seen it. So right. I had to basically put it to people who had seen it. Really quickly, this another film that got released in Europe first.
Yeah, it seems to be happening a lot these days.
Yeah. I understand it with some of the others because they want to get the box office up. Maybe that's what they were trying to do here, too. Yeah. This one, I think it was a more complicated release pattern. And you guys can talk about that a little bit more in 2 days when...
we will.
You know, but that's the thing. So I asked some of my European friends. I'm like, you've seen it. Yeah. What can I pair it with? And I got a whole bunch of answers. I got a bunch of Ridley Scott. I got Alien and I got Blade Runner. But the one movie that stuck out for me and I rewatched was Contact. Robert Zemeckis' film, 1997.
I believe that's right.
I've got it on my screen. Why don't
and
I
this is
look?
A better pairing than mine. I will say that right off
the top. You know what? No, there was a lot of stuff in yours when I was watching it. There were a lot of themes, as I said, especially on terms of what people do for faith and how far they're willing to go. There are, and just the scope of a Ridley Scott film to get you into the mindset of what this guy can do when you just drop $100 million into his lap.
Totally.
Yeah, exactly. In the age of digital effects, he makes it look very, very organic. So I think there's a lot to be said between those two films. Contact, very, very different. Indeed, 1997. Robert Zemeckis, back when he wasn't making every movie with motion capture. Dude, get back to that, please.
He's finally done it. He's got this
about
bloody
well time.
Happening.
I know.
Yeah.
But in case people haven't seen it, it stars Jodie Foster as a research scientist. She specializes in search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And one day, she hears something. She's buddy-buddy with Matthew McConaughey, who's a theologian. And the whole story comes down to two things. One, what to do about this signal that America and the world decides whether or not they want to chase, and all the logistics of that ensues. And the question, the ultimate question of faith versus science. In case people have gotten this far and are completely unclear, Matthew and I do not mean to offend anyone with our questions and comments about it.
Hopefully not. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So take this all with just a grain of salt. And if you sat down and said we were wrong, we wouldn't disagree. So there's that. But why, especially now that I've seen the film that they match up, is that ultimate question of existentialism.
To an extent, yeah.
Why, you know, why are we here? Are we here just because of science and molecules and how the universe exploded millions and millions of years ago? Are we here by some great reason? And how far are we supposed to go down either road, be it science or be it spiritualism, on faith? Because even in science, there are things that cannot be proven.
Yeah.
But you still choose to believe them. And even just in your day-to-day life, in Contact, the question comes up of, did you love this person? And the answer is yes. It's a pretty easy answer, but they say prove it. And the fact that you can't, it's kind of that direct challenge to, well, you know, not everything can be proven.
Yeah.
Prometheus, of course, all this comes up as well.
Well, I think both films ultimately are, you know, and you're absolutely right. It's a great way to put it that, you know, there is a question of how far down either path do you go on just blind faith. But I think both films, what ultimately, aside from the fact that I really do believe that Ellie in Prometheus is named after Ellie in Contact, I think it's a direct reference.
Could be.
But,
and if so, great pull.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why I got so excited when you said that this was the film. But I think both films are actually kind of arriving at the same point, which is saying, you know, at the end of the day, to kind of explain away the needs of the human race, both reason and faith are incomplete answers. You need to be willing to kind of go further, to combine them in some way and move beyond that. And I think that that's ultimately what actually, to a very direct degree, Contact and Prometheus have to say at the end of the story.
I think the one thing I like in both films, and this is kind of something I mentioned earlier with the whole, you know, God wills it, is you have to be willing to have your faith challenged.
Yes.
If there's something that raises my ire, it's the concept of blasphemy. You know, aside from desecration, I don't believe that discourse and question should count as blasphemy.
I would agree.
I think that, you know, and whether or not you have to give an answer then and there, you have to listen to the question.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and that's what comes up, because in Prometheus, after, you know, after Ellie comes back, after she's had her close encounter, pardon the pun, David he's basically tending to her medically, and he goes to take off her crucifix around her neck, and he said, "I find it curious that you still wear this, even though you now think you have a more complete answer."
Yes,
you know, and that's the thing. Is she only wearing that because she believes in God and she's a Christian? She was raised that way. Or has that become something more for her? Has this not given her a complete answer?
Yeah. Did she think, you know, all of these years that whatever the God represented by that cross is, that she was going to find him on LV-223? Or did she just, was it just a metaphor for her? You know, it's one of those things that we don't really know at the end of the film. But it's interesting to watch when she chooses to take that cross off and when she chooses to put it back on, like where she is at those moments in the film.
It's a similar thing that Ellie Arroway in Contact has to go through, because as the mission and the ideas become flushed out, they pose some very, very daunting ideas of, okay, here's the message to you, and oh, by the way, this message is embedded with a Hitler propaganda piece of film. Now, once you figure that out, it tells you to build this monstrously expensive and wildly dangerous contraption. Oh, by the way, along the way, we're going to kill one of your guys. Mm-hmm. And you then have to decide whether you still want to keep going down this road. Her science is probably questioned more than her faith. Like, you know, even right down to the concept that there's no reason to think that an extraterrestrial life would be aggressive, because they've evolved beyond us.
Right.
And they all say, well, why do you think that? Just because they've evolved beyond us, I think the comparison is to a molehill in ants on a molehill.
Yeah.
You know, how much reservation would you have in destroying ants on a molehill?
Yeah.
And that's the same thing that we go through in Prometheus, of even though you think you have an answer and it now challenges everything, how much further are you willing to go?
Right. And how much, like, I mean, when you kick open that door to try to know more, you may learn significantly more than you can handle, right? It might be why people don't like Prometheus, right? They didn't want, they have their idea of what the alien universe is like, and then they kicked open the door to
they
more
wanted
knowledge.
I think people wanted 10 Little Indians again.
Yeah.
I really think that's what it was.
But they kicked open, same thing with Phantom Menace. They kicked open that door, they learned things in Phantom Menace, they learned about the midichlorians.
Right? Yeah.
Nobody wanted to learn about the midichlorians. They liked the Force the way it was. It's always the same thing, right? Like, when you open yourself to learning more, to more knowledge, you're running the risk that you're going to get something different from what you wanted. And, you know, both Prometheus and Contact, I think, take these principal characters who at the beginning couldn't be more opposite, because Ellie Arroway is a scientist and an atheist, and Elizabeth Shaw is a person of faith and an archaeologist, I guess, whatever the hell that means 100 years from now. And yet kind of puts them through the exact same thing of, like, okay, you think you know what you want. You think you know what the answer to the question you're asking, what you want that answer to be. It's not that. You're getting something else. Can you deal with it?
Science and faith have always had this butting of heads, and I really think that they're more married than I think that's what the two films really have in common.
That's what I'm saying.
Are so much more married than people want to believe.
The two films are both saying they are married, that these things work together, that they are a more complete answer together than they are separately, which is actually further than I personally believe in my own life. But I understand the need. Like, I understand why faith exists. I understand what answers I should be looking for down that line of thought.
Towards the end of Contact, even, like, after the whole direction that the movie takes, and I actually ultimately love, not when she takes the journey. Like, when she takes the journey, that's pretty cool, and where that goes, I think that's where a lot of people who saw it, they kind of drifted away from it because it was just too much.
It's very weird. It's table stakes, right? Same thing
it
as
is.
Prometheus. It's like those engineers are weird.
Yeah, but
it's
but
a weird
thing
idea.
But the thing is, where that machine takes them is not the end.
Yeah.
The end is the fallout of everything and how it seems to everybody who's back here versus what Ellie claims that she experienced. And the whole idea that she is now having her science, her observation challenge, and saying, well, we have to take all of your observations on faith because the only person who observed them here was you.
Yeah.
And what I like, though, about that and what both films represent is she, once we get beyond that part, she's talking to, like, a bunch of school kids.
Yeah.
And she says, you know, maybe you think that there's life out there. Maybe you don't think that there's life out there. The important thing is for you to never stop asking questions and make up your own answers.
Right.
You know, and that, I think, is kind of ultimately what both films have in common and work really, really well. It's aged
Oh boy.
Very well, which sci-fi doesn't. And I kind of think this is going to hold true for Prometheus as well, because it's not wildly effects heavy.
No.
Which neither is Alien, by the way. True. That film is, talk about a film that's aged marvelously. But Contact has aged very, very well, both in terms of the discussion and what we see. The performances are awesome.
Totally.
It's another film that's loaded with great actors.
Contact is really weirdly of its time. Like, it does feel like a very mid-90s movie to me. You know, everything's very high-key. All the special effects are definitely from the first few years of digital.
Yeah.
But it is so solidly made, right? Like, it is very self-assured. Every shot is nicely picked, nicely placed. The performances, like you said, are all very strong. That even as I was kind of adjusting to my 1997 brain for the first, like, say, 20 minutes... I just got carried into the story because it has that timelessness to it, right? It has that same sort of, I call it the brick shithouse construction of like the classic films, where it's like they weren't overtly stylish and showy, they were just really well made.
Yeah.
They were constructed well, and Contact definitely constructed well, and that holds up forever.
It's kind of funny. The one thing that I think actually that dates it is the way in which information moves around.
Oh, sure.
Because in that movie, God bless it, in that movie it's all through TV.
Yeah.
And
all the TVs are square? And that blew my mind. I was like, oh yeah, TVs used to be square.
Yeah,
like,
very recently.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. No, but yeah, that's the thing, because now all of this information will be zipping around a lot faster. Fact and rumor would be so much harder to discern, but yeah. God
help us if we make contact with alien life on Twitter.
Oh, we're screwed. We are so screwed. I think the takeaway for me in this movie really, really is it's Matthew McConaughey, actually. Because he's the one that actually asks the question, and he asks it from a person of faith, which kind of goes against a lot of what we've been talking. But he says, are we better off with what science has brought us? And I don't think he's thinking of stuff like antibiotics. I think he's thinking about, he's talking about stuff like communication. He's talking about even something as ease of moving money around, that kind of thing. And I got to thinking about that. Are we better off? Like, okay, for instance, if it were not for technology in the information age, I would never have met you. We were talking before about how I've lived, you know, myself and Lindsay have lived nearby you through quite a lot.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever would have met you were it not for technology. But I think at the same time, I think where it would come down to him is there's the human element involved. I could have just been lobbing comments with you for months, if not years.
Sure.
Even though we're still in the same city. Because a lot of people say, oh, well, it's a guy and I'm not going to go for a beer or anything like that. So are we better off, for instance, that the whole world is now connected? That we are all able to kind of get ourselves into the mindset of each other a lot better? Is that helping us, or are we still staying more remote? Are we the actual thing that we want, as McConaughey's character, Palmer Joss, says, is contact and emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, was the takeaway of, have we really evolved?
Right.
Has this taken us to a good place?
Yeah, and for me, the takeaway is the moment of oneness for Ellie at the end, after the space mission, where she's in the courtroom and she says, I accept. As a scientist, I must accept the possibility that what I saw was not real. But I believe it, right?
Yeah.
Like, I saw it. I felt it.
Yeah, because they say, why don't you recant your whole...
Yeah.
And she says, I can't deny what I felt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there we go. If you have seen Prometheus and you're looking for something else to watch, these are two films that we think can go really well. And I think it's a pretty good little feature for the podcast. I might kind of keep this around.
Yeah, that's been good.
A little bit more often. Certainly kind of beats the shit out of a top five. That is episode 60 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, June 25th for episode 61. We'll be talking about Pixar's Brave. Matthew Brown can be heard on Memo, which you can find on memo.ca, row3.com, and in the iTunes Music Store. You can also find him sporadically on thesubstream.com. And his writing can be found...
All of my stuff can be found at my website, which is tedrick.com. That will have links to Mamo, to Row 3, and to the Substream.
There we
go. It's your one-stop Matt Brown shop.
By the time this episode goes up, your podcast about Prometheus will probably be up as well.
Very likely, yeah.
Anything else coming up that people can look forward to
the
next week or so?
All this past week, I did a lengthy series looking back on the Alien franchise on Substream.com, including my very spoiler-heavy Prometheus review just today. I can't believe it's actually only been a week. And we are cooking some stuff for The Dark Knight Rises at the Substream, which obviously is not going to hit until about the second week of July, but it is going to be delightful.
Nice. My site is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Blueberry, the iTunes Music Store, all of them. They give you handy ways to subscribe and find out when new episodes are up. Feedback on Prometheus, on the weakest Pixar film that's not named Cars, or either of the films we talked about in The Other Side, or even just what you thought about The Other Side as a new addition to the podcast. I'm actually really curious about that part. Let me know. Comment section of the site. Email me, ryan@thematinee.ca. Twitter, I'm matinee_ca, or facebook.com/darkmatinee. Any last thoughts, sir?
No, just thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this and to Prometheus in about equal measure.
For the first part, you're crazy. For the second part, I totally can relate. For Matt, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee. Find me in the matinee.